Chapter 27. Rapid rattling sound grew upon her hearing. Bizarre and incomprehensible, it arrested Mrs. Verloc's attention. Then as its character became plain to the ear, she stopped short, amazed and concerned. Striking a match on the box she held in her hand, she turned on and lighted, above the parlor table, one of the two gas burners, which, being defective, first whistled as if astonished, and then went on purring comfortably like a cat. Mr. Verloc, against his usual practice, had thrown off his overcoat. It was lying on the sofa. His hat, which he must also have thrown off, rested overturned under the edge of the sofa. He had dragged a chair in front of the fireplace, and his feet planted inside the fender, his head held between his hands, he was hanging low over the glowing grate. His teeth rattled with an ungovernable violence, causing his whole enormous back to tremble at the same rate. Mrs. Verloc was startled. "You've been getting wet," she said. "Not very," Mr. Verloc managed to falter out, in a profound shudder. By a great effort he suppressed the rattling of his teeth. "I'll have you laid up on my hands," she said, with genuine uneasiness. "I don't think so," remarked Mr. Verloc, snuffling huskily. He had certainly contrived somehow to catch an abominable cold between 7 in the morning and 5 in the afternoon. Mrs. Verloc looked at his bowed back. "Where have you been today?" she asked. "Nowhere," answered Mr. Verloc in a low, choked nasal tone. His attitude suggested a grieved sulks or a severe headache. The insufficiency and uncandidness of his answer became painfully apparent in the dead silence of the room. He snuffled apologetically, and added "I've been to the bank." Mrs. Verloc became attentive. "You have," she said dispassionately. "At 4? Mr. Verloc mumbled, with his nose over the grate, and with marked unwillingness. "Draw the money out." "What do you mean? All of it?" "Yes. All of it." Mrs. Verloc spread out with care the scanty tablecloth, got two knives and two forks out of the table drawer, and suddenly stopped in her methodical proceedings. "What did you do that for?" "May want it soon," snuffled vaguely Mr. Verloc, who was coming to the end of his calculated indiscretions. "I don't know what you mean," remarked his wife in a tone perfectly casual, but standing stock still between the table and the cupboard. "You know you can trust me," Mr. Verloc remarked to the grate, with hoarse feeling. Mrs. Verloc turned slowly towards the cupboard, saying with deliberation, "Oh yes, I can trust you." And she went on with her methodical proceedings. She laid two plates, got the bread, the butter, going to and fro quietly between the table and the cupboard in the peace and silence of her home. On the point of taking out the jam, she reflected practically, "He will be feeling hungry, having been away all day," and she returned to the cupboard once more to get the cold beef. She set it under the purring gas jet, and with a passing glance at her motionless husband hugging the fire, she went down two steps into the kitchen. It was only when coming back, carving knife and fork in hand, that she spoke again. "If I hadn't trusted you, I wouldn't have married you." Bowed under the overmantel, Mr. Verloc, holding his head in both hands, seemed to have gone to sleep. Winnie made the tea, and called out in an undertone, "Adolphe." Mr. Verloc got up at once, and staggered a little, before he sat down at the table. His wife, examining the sharp edge of the carving knife, placed it on the dish, and called his attention to the cold beef. He remained insensible to the suggestion, with his chin on his breast. "You should feed your cold," Mrs. Verloc said dogmatically. He looked up, and shook his head. His eyes were bloodshot, and his face red. His fingers had ruffled his hair into a dissipated untidiness. Altogether he had a disreputable aspect, expressive of the discomfort, the irritation and the gloom following a heavy debauch. But Mr. Verloc was not a debauched man. In his conduct he was respectable. His appearance might have been the effect of a feverish cold. He drank 3 cups of tea, but abstained from food entirely. He recoiled from it with somber aversion, when urged by Mrs. Verloc, who said at last, "Aren't your feet wet? You had better put on your slippers. You aren't going out any more this evening." Mr. Verloc intimated by morose grunts and signs that his feet were not wet, and that anyhow he did not care. The proposal as to slippers was disregarded as beneath his notice. But the question of going out in the evening received an unexpected development. It was not of going out in the evening that Mr. Verloc was thinking. His thoughts embraced a vaster scheme. From moody and incomplete phrases it became apparent that Mr. Verloc had been considering the expediency of emigrating. It was not very clear whether he had in his mind France or California. The utter unexpectedness, improbability, and inconceivableness of such an event robbed this vague declaration of all its effect. Mrs. Verloc, as placidly as if her husband had been threatening her with the end of the world, said, "The idea! Mr. Verloc declared himself sick and tired of everything, and besides," she interrupted him, "you've a bad cold." It was indeed obvious that Mr. Verloc was not in his usual state, physically and even mentally. A somber irresolution held him silent for a while. Then he murmured a few ominous generalities on the theme of necessity. "We'll have to," repeated Winnie, sitting calmly back, with folded arms, opposite her husband. "Should like to know who's to make you. You ain't a slave. No one need be a slave in this country, and don't you make yourself one." She paused, and with invincible unsteady candor, "He business isn't so bad," she went on. "You've a comfortable home." She glanced all around the parlor, from the corner cupboard to the good fire in the grate. Ensconced cozily behind the shop of doubtful wares, with the mysteriously dim window, and its door suspiciously ajar in the obscure and narrow street, it was in all essentials of domestic propriety and domestic comfort a respectable home. Her devoted affection missed out of it her brother Stevie, now enjoying a damp villegiature in the Kentish lanes under the care of Mr. Michaelis. She missed him poignantly, with all the force of her protecting passion. This was the boy's home to the roof, the cupboard, the stoked grate. On this thought Mrs. Verloc rose, and walking to the other end of the table, said in the fullness of her heart, "And you are not tired of me." Mr. Verloc made no sound. Winnie leaned on his shoulder from behind, and pressed her lips to his forehead. Thus she lingered. Not a whisper reached them from the outside world. The sound of footsteps on the pavement died out in the discreet dimness of the shop. Only the gas jet above the table went on purring equably in the brooding silence of the parlor. During the contact of that unexpected and lingering kiss, Mr. Verloc, gripping with both hands the edges of his chair, preserved a hieratic immobility. When the pressure was removed he let go the chair, rose, and went to stand before the fireplace. He turned no longer his back to the room. With his features swollen and an air of being drugged, he followed his wife's movements with his eyes. Mrs. Verloc went about serenely, clearing up the table. Her tranquil voice commented the idea thrown out in a reasonable and domestic tone. It wouldn't stand examination. She condemned it from every point of view. But her only real concern was Stevie's welfare. He appeared to her thought in that connection as sufficiently peculiar, not to be taken rashly abroad. And that was all. But talking round that vital point, she approached absolute vehemence in her delivery. Meanwhile, with brusque movements, she arrayed herself in an apron for the washing up of cups. And as if excited by the sound of her uncontradicted voice, she went so far as to say in a tone almost tart, "If you go abroad you'll have to go without me." "You know I wouldn't," said Mr. Verloc huskily, and the unresonant voice of his private life trembled with an enigmatical emotion. Already Mrs. Verloc was regretting her words. They had sounded more unkind than she meant them to be. They had also the unwisdom of unnecessary things. In fact, as he had not meant them at all. It was a sort of phrase that is suggested by the demon of perverse inspiration. But she knew a way to make it as if it had not been. She turned her head over her shoulder and gave that man planted heavily in front of the fireplace a glance, half arch, half cruel, out of her large eyes a glance, of which the Winnie of the Belgravian mansion days would have been incapable, because of her respectability and her ignorance. But the man was her husband now, and she was no longer ignorant. She kept it on him for a whole second, with her grave face motionless like a mask, while she said playfully, "You couldn't. You would miss me too much." Mr. Verloc started forward. "Exactly," he said in a louder tone, throwing his arms out and making a step towards her. Something wild and doubtful in his expression made it appear uncertain whether he meant to strangle or to embrace his wife. But Mrs. Verloc's attention was called away from that manifestation by the clatter of the shop bell. "Shop, Adolf. You go." He stopped, his arms came down slowly. "You go," repeated Mrs. Verloc. "I've got my apron on." Mr. Verloc obeyed woodenly, stony-eyed, and like an automaton whose face had been painted red. And this resemblance to a mechanical figure went so far that he had an automaton's absurd air of being aware of the machinery inside of him. He closed the parlor door, and Mrs. Verloc, moving briskly, carried the tray into the kitchen. She washed the cups and some other things before she stopped in her work to listen. No sound reached her. The customer was a long time in the shop. It was a customer, because if he had not been, Mr. Verloc would have taken him inside. Undoing the strings of her apron with a jerk, she threw it on the chair and walked back to the parlor slowly. At that precise moment, Mr. Verloc entered from the shop. He had gone in red. He came out a strange papery white. His face, losing its drugged, feverish stupor, had in that short time acquired a bewildered and harassed expression. He walked straight to the sofa, and stood looking down at his overcoat lying there, as though he were afraid to touch it. "What's the matter?" asked Mrs. Verloc in a subdued voice. Through the door left ajar, she could see that the customer was not gone yet. "I find I'll have to go out this evening," said Mr. Verloc. He did not attempt to pick up his outer garment. Without a word, Winnie made for the shop, and shutting the door after her, walked in behind the counter. She did not look overtly at the customer till as he had established herself comfortably on the chair. But by that time, as he had noted, that he was tall and thin, and wore his mustaches twisted up. In fact, he gave the sharp points a twist just then. His long, bony face rose out of a turned-up collar. He was a little splashed, a little wet. A dark man, with the ridge of the cheekbone well defined under the slightly hollow temple. A complete stranger. Not a customer either. Mrs. Verloc looked at him placidly. "You came over from the continent?" she said after a time. The long, thin stranger, without exactly looking at Mrs. Verloc, answered only by a faint and peculiar smile. Mrs. Verloc's steady, incurious gaze rested on him. "You understand English, don't you?" "Oh yes. I understand English." There was nothing foreign in his accent, except that he seemed in his slow enunciation to be taking pains with it. And Mrs. Verloc, in her varied experience, had come to the conclusion that some foreigners could speak better English than the natives. She said, looking at the door of the parlor fixedly, "You don't think perhaps of staying in England for good?" The stranger gave her again a silent smile. He had a kindly mouth and probing eyes. And he shook his head a little sadly, it seemed. "My husband will see you through all right. Meantime, for a few days you couldn't do better than take lodgings with Mr. Giugliani. Continental Hotel it's called. Private. It's quiet. My husband will take you there." "A good idea," said the thin, dark man, whose glance had hardened suddenly. "You knew Mr. Verloc before, didn't you? Perhaps in France?" "I have heard of him," admitted the visitor in his slow, painstaking tone, which yet had a certain curtness of intention. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.